Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Robin Morse from the University of Virginia.
And I'm the co-host, Ahmed Mazmi from Princeton University.
Today, I'm here to talk to Professor Hideaki Suzuki, the author of Slave Trade Profiteers in the Western Indian Ocean, Suppression and Resistance in the 19th Century, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. Dr. Suzuki is an associate professor at the National Museum of Ethnology in Osaka, Japan. By discussing this book, we will explore how slave traders interacted with and resisted the British suppression campaign in the 19th century Western Indian Ocean. By focusing on the transporters, buyers, sellers, and users of slaves in the region, this book traces the many links between slave trafficking and other types of trade. Drawing upon first-person slave accounts, travelogues, and archival sources, it documents the impact of abolition on Zanzibar politics, Indian merchants, East African coastal urban societies, and the entirety of maritime trade in the region. Ultimately, this groundbreaking work uncovers how Western Indian Ocean societies experienced the slave trade suppression campaign as a political intervention, with important implications for Indian Ocean history and the history of the slave trade. Welcome, Hideaki, to the New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to this wonderful opportunity. I'm looking forward to talk with you today.
Thanks. So we're going to start off. Can you start us off by saying a couple words about yourself, that is, where you grew up, where you went to school, and how you became interested in your field of study, and perhaps any influential mentors you had?
Oh, yeah, sure. I was born in Tokyo, then I grew up in several places. When I was 8 years old, our family moved to Moscow. I mean, my father was sent to Moscow, and we followed him. I mean, he was sent by a company. Then in 1988, we once went back to Japan and stayed for a few months, then moved again to Seoul, South Korea. The same reason my father's company sent him. I don't know the reason why my father's company sent him so frequently. Maybe because he was a good worker or maybe not. Anyway, I stayed altogether 5.5 years outside Japan. And this experience eventually pushed me to go to the field, I mean the history of the Indian Ocean world. Let me tell you what I mean. In these 5.5 years, I went to Japanese school and in Moscow because at the time it was still Soviet Union. Although perestroika was going on, we lived in an apartment where only foreigners lived, of course, including many Japanese families. And in Seoul as well, we lived in the area where many Japanese families lived. And this circumstance, I didn't necessarily touch local people, local culture, and local society. I mean, I didn't know almost anything about Russia or South Korea. Of course, I touched these sometimes, partly because I was some sort of adventurous kid. I still remember when I rode subway by myself in Moscow alone, and a kind gentleman sitting next to me asked me where I go. I answered in Russian, like blah, blah, station I want to go. I cannot speak Russian now. I forgot almost anything except some small greeting words and some songs. But that time I was so nice Russian speaker, so I could communicate in Russian. Then anyway, he got off before I get off. Then that gentleman asked an old woman sitting next to me, the other side. I mean, he asked her to teach me when the tube reached the station, which I should get off. This is one of many good memories in these days. But I realized when I was a high school student, I mean, after coming back to Japan, although I had these nice memories, I didn't know anything about these people, culture, society. And at the time, 1980s and 80s and 90s, still there were few foreigners in Japan. There were, of course, but quite few. So I did have a great opportunity to get into other world, which were not common for many of my friends in Japan, but I didn't take that chance. This kind of feeling, it's not a regret, it's not miss. I don't know proper English word. Maybe in Japanese, I don't know the proper word to express this feeling, but this kind of feeling reminds in my mind. Then when I entered the university, I chose history department because I loved so much my grandparents and then I loved to listen to their old stories. So history was very close to me even at the time. And for me at the time, history seems to be the subject in which I can access what I couldn't get in my childhood. I mean, understanding of people, culture, society, which physically is so far from where I am. And my undergraduate was Gakushuin University. Professors in the history department are very nice. And my first mentor there was Professor Norihiko Fukui. He's a specialist of modern French history, and then also he introduced Michel Foucault and Annales School to Japanese readers. And then in the freshman seminar, we read his book in turn. That book features recent trend of historical studies, such like gender or something like that. And by accident, my chapter was Maritime Network. And I can tell you, actually, I wanted to be in charge another chapter. But immediately after my starting preparation, I noticed this topic is fascinating. Because this is a history of encounter. Encounter of different people, different culture, different society. I mean, I noticed this is a topic which I was looking for. And then also, this is a history of adventure, which remind me of my wanderlust in a childhood in Moscow or Seoul, like traveling alone to my friend's house, or, I don't know if you know, Dragon Quest, a role-playing video game which I played when I was a kid. I'm not so big fan of these games, but most of Japanese kids in the late 80s played these role-playing video game to shake their wanderlust. I was one of them. So I fixed my focus on the Indian Ocean world history from the very early stage, not by introduction of some professor, but from my experience in the childhood. But at the same time, I was focusing on medieval times of the Indian Ocean world history, not the 19th century, which I'm studying now, largely because of the influence of the works done by Professor Hikoichi Yajima. I didn't meet him in person, just reading his works at that time. He's a kind of Japanese Braudel on the Indian Ocean world history. He has advocated the Indian Ocean world since the late 1960s. And then he's a medievalist using mainly Arabic sources. So for me, at that time, Indian Ocean world history was something medieval. But anyway, that's all the beginning of my study in the Indian Ocean world history.
Thank you. And so you've earned your PhD from Tokyo University, writing about the modern Indian Ocean slave trade. In that regard, would you describe the status of the Indian Ocean world history as a field in Japanese academia, and where do you see some of its current and future directions?
Yeah, thank you so much. That's a great question. Probably, firstly, I like to introduce what I what is called Kaiikishi, which is very important for Japanese historians working on the Indian Ocean world history, then go into Indian Ocean world history per se. That's comfortable to me. In Japan, we have a Kaiikishi studies. Kaiikishi is a Japanese term, and Kaiiki is literally maritime region, and shi is history. So history of maritime region, that's the meaning of Kaiikishi. So we have Indian Ocean Kaiikishi, East Asian Kaiikishi, Asian Kaiikishi, also Atlantic Kaiikishi, for example. But largely, Kaiikishi studies have been developed in the field of East Asian waters and the Indian Ocean. And then Kaiikishi is not the same as maritime history in Anglophone academia. Kaiikishi has been established fundamentally to challenge conventional narratives of history, such as land-centered history, also nation-based history, and it keeps this original aim till now. So some Japanese Kaiikishi scholars translate their work into English using maritime history or blah, 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 but I don't think it's a good translation. Anyway, I mean, this sort of spirit of Kaiikishi met global history, the concern of the global history in the mid-2000s in Japan. In Japan, researchers work individually, but they often make a joint project with other researchers, which are usually or often supported by funding from Japan Society for Promoting Science. And there were several Kaiikishi-related projects since then, but the largest impact was brought by what is called the Ningpo Project. And the Ningpo is the name of port town in China, and that project tried to locate the formation of Japanese traditional culture into East Asian maritime sphere. This was a actually very big project involving not only historian per se, specialist on the literature, religion, etc. But one of the teams in that project, they tried to write about the progress of East Asian Kaiikishi, and many early career researchers, like a PhD students, joined it. I also joined partly, and this project opened the entrance of Kaiikishi studies widely to the younger scholars. And then these younger scholars are kind of like a core of Kaiikishi studies today. And then currently, Kaiikishi seems to have established a certain position in Japanese academia. And then Kaiiki framework itself seems to attract not only historians now, but also all scholars in the neighboring field, such as area studies. I've heard that several new area studies projects will be set up centering the oceanic space, including the Indian Ocean, in the next couple of years. So if it's really set up, the Indian Ocean world studies in Japan goes to next stage. I mean, not only historian, but involving other neighboring field scholars. And then as for the Indian Ocean world history, if we follow Michael Pearson's way, I mean, to set the eastern end of the Indian Ocean world at Malacca Strait, we have some dozens of scholars currently working on. And before 2000, most of the people worked on the medieval times and then early modern, partly because of the influence of Professor Yajima's work as I introduced. But last 20 years, the number of people began to work, a number of people began to work on the late 18th to the 19th century and even 20th century. And I'm one of them. And then recently, we start to have some kind of like a joint project. Actually, one of them I joined, which was led by Professor Kaoru Sugihara. Probably some of you might know, he's quite famous for his intra-Asian trading network. And he tried to analyze Indian Ocean world from an economic history perspective. So as such like that, I mean now the joint project of the Indian Ocean world started, and probably it's gonna be increased in the near future. Futures are direction. Let me talk about not only Indian Ocean, but Kaiikishi as a whole. Probably we can find commonality with the Indian Ocean world history. The big advantage of Kaiikishi is to highlight connectedness which easily cross borders set by conventional perspective of history, such as border between land and sea, border of nations, etc. So more and more we talk about kaikishi, we can more and more relativize existing borders. But simultaneously, in this process, we are creating border around kaiki itself. This is what I call dilemma of kaikishi studies. So more and more we talk about Indian Ocean world, for example, then existing border of Indian history, Persian Gulf history, Swahili history would reduce its significance and then merge together. But at the same time, I'm wondering whether we create border of Indian Ocean world per se. So how could we get over this dilemma would be a crucial question to any people working on kaikishi, including Indian Ocean world history. So current trend in Japan, connecting kaikishi with global history might be a solution. But fundamentally, how we can build the concept of kaiki or world of Indian Ocean world, including dynamics of both opening or aperta and closing or unity. And this challenge is not only the issue for kaikishi and an Indian Ocean world historians, but more general issue to any historians, I think.
That's fascinating. So now we're going to turn to the book and its chapters. The book consists of 8 chapters and an introduction conclusion. So can you tell us a little bit about how the book idea developed? What was the research process like? And your writing experience? And because this is a podcast concerned with the Indian Ocean world, can you discuss your second investigative question a little more in depth here and why you felt it was important to frame your book this way?
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. Okay. So as I told you, at the beginning, I focus on the medieval times. And then until my master's thesis, actually, I worked on the medieval Western Indian Ocean, focusing on East African coast. So my BA thesis was about oceanic migration history to the East African coast, combining typology of mosques and ruins, and then typology of oral traditions like a Shiraji tradition. Then my master thesis in turn used medieval Arab geographical works such as Idrisi or Abul Fida, not exactly geographer, but Al-Masudi, etc., to trace the transition of image of East African coast or Bilad Zanj in this literature. So I'm not the 19th century guy from the beginning, rather latecomer. And then when I started my PhD project, I left medieval stuff behind. Actually, my first proposal on a PhD project was to compose some critical editions of Shiraji traditions. Because several PhD students in the University of Tokyo at the time work on this sort of project and then look solid. Then I brought my proposal to Professor Masashi Haneda. He became my PhD mentor, but we knew each other since my undergraduate, and I joined his seminar during my master. Although he was professor at the University of Tokyo while I was not a student there. And he gave me always useful advice to push me forward. And he gave me many chances, for example, to read my paper at his workshop where I can get to know many wonderful scholars in and outside Japan. So I owe quite a lot to him. Anyway, when I brought my proposal and he saw my proposal, he asked me a question. Do you really want to do this? To be honest, no. To compose critical edition of Shiraji tradition, that's quite important work, but this is not work for me, but probably work for more solid person. And he asked me what I really want to do. I answered, I like not to focus on some part of the Indian Ocean world, a particular region, but I like to argue the movement of the whole Indian Ocean world. And then also I like to use my field experience into my work. And he said, you can write your proposal so and do it. And so I do it. So at the beginning of my research, I read again existing literatures on the Indian Ocean world history. It was some 15 years ago or a bit more, so the number of the works was not so much. Starting with Auguste Toussaint's work, Q.T. Chaudhary, André Wink, and many other works, including collection of conference paper up to Michael Pearson's Indian Ocean, and then Eric Gilbert's Dhow Trade, which were just came out at the time. I've already read many of them, but mainly the sections around the medieval times. So this time, I carefully read how did these literature draw the picture after the early modern times. That's my question. Then I found out that most of them, almost except Pearson and Gilbert, didn't say almost anything on the 19th century. They argue that the Indian Ocean world as a historical unit didn't work any longer, or it was collapsed after European influence dominated economically as well as politically since the mid-18th century. Sooner or later, I noticed that this understanding corresponds with views provided by Immanuel Wallerstein or André Günther Frank or Ferdinand Braudel. They also argue that the historical unit of the Indian Ocean was incorporated in the European origin world economy. Of course, I cannot deny the fact that many places of many regions of the Indian Ocean were colonized by European powers, and economical exploitation is also not deniable. But the question came up to my mind at the time was, although colonization and economic exploitation have taken place, does it mean the collapse of the historical unity of the Indian Ocean world? For example, many of these authors regard Dhows as a symbol of the Indian Ocean world. So after colonization or incorporation into world economy, did these Dhows stop sailing? No. Eric Gilbert's work on colonial Zanzibar illustrated how the Dhow trade gradually moved toward the periphery, but still exists. If you visit Zanzibar, there is modern harbor. If you travel from Dar es Salaam with ferry, you arrive at that harbor, and there you can find one or two gigantic container ships, and then hundreds of containers on their harbors. And many visitors turn right to go to the stone town. But if you turn left and then go straight, then you reach Dhow Harbor. It's a huge difference, huge gap of circumstance. Modern harbor with concrete, you can walk smoothly, while Dhow Harbor is in very poor condition, especially to be compared with modern one. So if you want to ride the Dhow, you need to jump on mud and sand beach with leaked oil and dead fishes. Of course, it's very smelly. Indeed, this shows vividly peripheral character of Dhows today. But firstly, Dhows are still there. And secondly, you can find out so lively atmosphere. Mangrove poles from the mainland are unloaded by workers one by one. Men and women are surrounding fishermen who just keep coming back with their fresh fishes. Of course, these Dhows nowadays do not travel to the Persian Gulf, for example, but still Dhows are there and people rely on Dhow transport at a certain degree, which are not ignorable. And if you go to the main market in a stone town and ask shopkeepers where these items come from, for example, rice, you can find out different kinds of rice from several regions of India or Pakistan. What is interesting is you can find similarity of this lineup today to the list of goods sold in the market in Zanzibar, written by Richard Burton, recording in the mid-1850s. I mean, you can find out some Indian Ocean-wide connection still there, and then that is quite similar to what Richard Burton observed almost like 150 years ago. And this kind of field experience made me doubt about existing theory about the collapse of the Indian Ocean world. And then this argument to conclude with the collapse of the Indian Ocean world by European influence or Western influence, I call it corruption theory. This is not misspelling of collapse and corrupt, But implication of corruption theory, corruption is that these arguments dismiss resilience or strength of this historical unity of the Indian Ocean world. And they are easily, I mean, these authors are easily washed off by East-West or Orient versus Occident dichotomy. So easily identifying European expansion with collapse of the Indian Ocean world is corrupted by the way of thinking to divide the world between Europe and the others, modern and pre-modern, civilized and uncivilized. Sugata Bose and Ned Barthes pointed out similarly. So since very early stage of my PhD project, I am keen to this issue. Then the question is how to tackle this corruption theory. Then I set focus on the 19th century, because it seems that this is a crucial period when the world economy expanded and colonialism as well. At a glance, 19th century seems to be a century of crisis and of the Indian Ocean world. So at initial stage, I decided to explore what's happened in the Indian Ocean world in that century of crisis. Then again, the question is what subject I focused on. It took a big time. First, I tried to look for sources which reveal local merchants' affairs. I found only a few records, not enough for the project. At that time, Professor Yuzo Shitomi, he's one of the few specialists on early South Arabian history, and made brilliant translation and detailed notes on Maris Ezraei. And he's another mentor of mine during my PhD. He kindly chose a book of BK's East African Slave Trade for his seminar. And he sometimes told me that slave trade would be an interesting topic, so you have to do. But I didn't incline so much immediately. I thought slave trade is something special business at the Atlantic. And then looking at the slave trade, it's not easy to catch the picture of the 19th century Indian Ocean world. But then I had an opportunity to visit India. I joined a project of architectural historians on a Kutch and a Gujarat. So I left Japan some 2 weeks or 3 weeks earlier than others and then stayed in Mumbai to visit Maharashtra State Archives. Then I explored some of the documents and finally found that actually slave trade was not a special business. Rather than that, it was a business many people involved, from king or sultan to baker, grain merchant, etc., and even slaves. So I ascertain I can find out some clue to tackle corruption theories through exploring slave trade. I was lucky to get research funds from JSPS. Then I could visit several archives after the Maharashtra archives. Then gradually I recognized the importance of multi-archival approach. For example, there was some incident in Zanzibar between French people and a Sultan, for example. It is natural there is a difference between description of that incident by French consul and that by British consul. But what is interesting is that there is also a difference between documents in the National Archives in the Kew, in the UK, and the Maharashtra State Archives. I mean, within British Empire, the contents of reports are different even though the same person reported the same incident. It's because British Consul at Zanzibar reported to Bombay government what Bombay government was interested in, and then the same British consul reported to London what foreign office was interested in. So the subject, like slave traders who didn't leave their own writings, such multi-archival approach is necessary to collect small tiny pieces and put together to look at the slave traders in various angles. It is indeed endless process, but it's fun. I was lucky to have funds, that's why I could do, but recently, like a Qatar Digital Library or Gallica in the Bibliothèque Nationale, day by day, more and more digital sources come to be available. So at least this approach come to be much easier than before.
Yes, indeed. The Qatar Digital Library has been very helpful in this time where we cannot travel. So to return to your first question of your book, can you give our listeners a sense of the land and seascape that you mentioned in your second chapter, that you mentioned, and the texture of the Western Indian Ocean slave trade in the 19th century. And then can you expand a little bit further on why you chose slave traders as your focus rather than the enslaved themselves, as is typical?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so the 19th century is the peak period of the slave trade in the Western Indian Ocean. Usually, we divide the Western Indian Ocean slave trade into two parts. One is Southern trade and the other is Northern trade. The Southern trade means slave trade across the Mozambique Channel and then towards the Mascareñ Islands, Mauritius, and La Réunion. For example, Mauritius shifted towards sugar monoculture economy when Britain settled their rule after Napoleonic War, so labor force was required. And the Madagascar Marina Kingdom settled their rule over the Madagascar Island, and this process produced many slaves for sale. And as you might know, Mozambique is the third largest export region towards the New World in the 19th century. So this southern trade connected also with the Atlantic slave trading network. Because of British suppression campaign of the West Africa, traders found they were relatively easy to sail from Mozambique to places like Brazil. That's the reason behind of the increase of the Mozambique in the Atlantic trade. And in this process, slave ground for Mozambique export eroded toward further interior after depopulation of just hinterlands. So in the Mozambique island, there were more Yao slaves than Makua slaves. The region where Yao came from is further interior than where the Makua lived. But my book mainly concerns with the other trade, Northern trade. In the Northern trade, 19th century was a century of African export. Previously, we have a variety of origins of slaves circulated in the Western Indian Ocean, in the northern part. Some from Georgia, others from India. Of course, there were many slaves from Africa. But in the 19th century, like a Turkmenchai Treaty concluded between Russian Empire and Qajar Iran, slave import from Central Asia became difficult. Since then, those who were in Qajar Iran demanded more African slaves than before. And the other side of the Persian Gulf, Arabian side, the 19th century, especially after the General Peace Treaty and a maritime truce, the demand of slaves increased. In the second half of the 19th century, dates and pearls became global commodities, which required more labor force than before, which were fulfilled with slaves. But the largest demand of the slaves in the 19th century northern trade was in the East African coast. East African coast had been functioned a major entry port for the slave trade already, but triggered by introduction of crop plantation along the coast required a slave labor force. In the mid-19th century, nearly half of slaves arrived at Zanzibar remained there. By the way, in the Western Indian Ocean, in general, we didn't have slave ships as we imagine. I mean, ships with full of slaves and then only slaves. The exception is a coastal trade between mainland of Africa and Zanzibar. But it's a short distance, at most 2 or 3 days voyage. But long distance, such as from Zanzibar to Muscat, usually a few slaves on board. And I mean, you can find out the graph in my book. And this is one of the reasons why I chose the slave traders as a subject. The question is what they carried apart from slaves. I came across not plentiful, but several shipping lists confiscated by naval patrol from ships with slaves, as I put in my book also. These items, apart from slaves on board, are grains, mangrove poles. I mean, these items. It is these items that have created Indian Ocean World. And my understanding of the Indian Ocean world is that fundamental element to create Indian Ocean world is flow of goods from the place where some goods are abundant to to the place where such goods were not abundant. Mangalore, for example, you can find out the roof of most of old architecture in the Persian Gulf. They are from East African coast historically. We have mangrove swamp in the Persian Gulf, but most of them are Avicenna marina. That is a type of mangrove. I mean, that mangrove, Avicenna marina, is very strong against high salinity concentration of seawater there. Therefore, almost only Avicenna marina you can find in the Persian Gulf. But they are very thin, and my informants told me in the Persian Gulf, they couldn't use local mangrove because they are weak. These mangrove poles are weak. So for example, like Ibn Haukal, the medieval Arab geographer, mentioned East African woods were used in buildings in a Siraf. Siraf was the major port in the Indian Ocean world located on the Iranian side, which was destroyed by the earthquake in the 10th century. But that wood used in the Siraf from East African coast, that should have been a mangrove. So going back to the main story, slave trade didn't exist alone, but along with other trade, which historically have created Indian Ocean world. This is the reason why I chose slave traders in order to grasp dynamic change of the Indian Ocean, Western Indian Ocean in the 19th century.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for elaborating on that further. So from all accounts, the 19th century was a period of change and transformation for these Indian Ocean slave traders. In your book, you focus on the decades between 1822 as the start of British attempts of suppression in the Indian Ocean, and 1873, when the Sultan of Zanzibar signed a treaty to end the slave trade formally, changing the power relations in East Africa, even as the slave trade lasted in the 20th century. However, in your analysis of these changing dynamics with the British, you examined practical and legal attempts to end the slave trade, as well as structural change post-1860. What were these changes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so periodization between 1822 and 73 is a classical one, but it's still important periodization from legal perspective of suppression. I mean, in these decades, legal foundation to illegalize slave trade had been established, but crucial period was by the end of the 50s. Without this foundation, the British couldn't intervene slave trade. And yes, indeed, slave trade continued up to the 20th century. And my last chapter deals with this issue while focusing on Acte de la Francisation, which I like to talk later. But anyway, in my book, actually, I didn't so much put emphasis on the importance of the period between 1822 and 1873. Yes, it's important, but as I told you, mainly in a legal sense. Instead of it, in order to capture structural change of the Western Indian Ocean associated with the slave trade and its suppression, I believe the turning of the 1860s is an important period. Firstly, because of participation of the Royal Navy in 1860, which was the subject of the chapter 4 of my book, and then secondly, separation of Busaidi into Oman and East Africa, also took place in the late 50s, and the East African Busaidi changed their attitude towards slave trade. I mean, they came to more British side, and this change and shifting towards plantation economy in Zanzibar made Zanzibar a new slave ground, and this brought quite unstable condition to Zanzibar, which also happened in around the turn of the 60s. And then also British consul forced the Indian residents along the East African coast to emancipate their holding slaves. That also took in the 60s, and their nationality issue developed in this decade. So all these changes were concentrated around the turn of the 1860s. So in the chapter 3, I deal with the progress of how legal foundation was established. That's the first aim. And then secondly, I like to examine the strategies how traders, especially transporters, faced to this establishment. Basically, transporters used anything in order to continue their trade. Transporters used their sailing skill, geographical knowledge, etc. Actually, their dhow was so fast, they could sail in good condition with 11 knots. 11 nautical knots, that's so fast. And then patrolling ship often missed these dhows. And then also they discovered new sailing routes, I mean these transporters. And as for geographical knowledge, Lamu Archipelago is very interesting. Lamu is northern end of Kenya today. If you go with a speedboat, 1.5 hours you are in Somalia. So Lamu Archipelago was surrounded by almost like a mangrove swamp, which make natural labyrinths. It's very complicated channels, and then some channels during low tide you cannot sail. I still remember in 1999, my first time to Lamu, I was on the local jahazi, local ships, and we were stuck in the middle of the channel due to low tide, and waited until high tide came. It took several hours. We were under the sun. So local sailors know this kind of things, and they can pass smoothly in channels. But the British Navy, Royal Navy, couldn't. Oh, for some reason, my captain in the 99 didn't as well. But only these skills and knowledge, but not only these skills and knowledge, but also they were watching very carefully the progress of anti-slave trade treaties. So when many Arabian chiefs in the Persian Gulf prohibited slave trade to their subject in the late 40s, they used Gajari ships. Because at the time, Gajarid didn't conclude anti-slave treaty with Britain. So Gajari ships could transport slaves without any interference by British patrol. So transporters could use even treaty network, which gradually choking their necks. But they don't care. They could use. Then they use in order to continue their trade or their transport. And with this resistance, Indian Navy couldn't succeed their campaign against slave trade.
Yes, in your fourth and fifth and sixth chapters, you elaborate and unpack on what you've started in the previous ones by tracing, reconsidering the Royal Navy's anti-slave trade campaign from the slave trader perspective to chains of reselling, reconsidering slave dealings based on slave-owned voices. And in the sixth chapter, the transformation of the East African coastal urban society in the slave distribution system. So for these chapters, I would like to ask about the available sources for accessing the voices of the enslaved individuals. And what are some of the challenges that you've encountered in writing these chapters? And in chapter four, so after a number of years without success, the British Royal Navy begins to participate in slave trade suppression in the Western Indian Ocean and commit to ending slavery, as we learn about in this chapter. What changed regarding British involvement and experiences of the slave profiteers? And perhaps you could remark on why East Africa was their focus in comparison with the Atlantic world.
Well, yeah, thank you so much. As for So may I start with chapter 5 or may I start with chapter 4?
Yes, as you like.
Okay. So, So I will start with the chapter 4. Oh, you are asking what kind of change could happen regarding British involvement and an experience by the slave transporters.
Mm-hmm.
And then also why East Africa was their focus. I mean, their Royal Navy's focus. So before involving of the British Royal Navy, the Indian Navy took in charge of suppression. Actually, Royal Navy was there, but they were so busy for other missions. And then Indian Navy was under the control of Bombay government. And they were the Bombay government was so much anxious about effect of suppression campaign to other commercial activities by the Indian merchants. So they were, the Indian Navy were not so eager to suppress the slave trade. I have to add this aspect to the background of insufficient campaign by Indian Navy, which I mentioned in the previous answer for their honor. And another reason of unsuccessful operation of the Indian Navy was their bounty system. You can get bounty, but you need to prove with the captured dhow. So can you imagine to bring the captured ship to Bombay in order to examination whenever you captured, while many other ships with slaves were coming? Otherwise, you continue cruising with captured dhow to seek for another. But this is the Indian Navy required. Then the examination sometimes took 2 years, and then during that period, the captain who captured the ship needed to feed crews of captured ships. If I were captain of the Indian Navy, I let these ships go. And then actually, some of the Indian Navy captain did. But the Royal Navy was different. They had their successful experience in the Atlantic, and the bounty system was different from the Indian Navy's. They can get bounty not by the number of slaves on board the captured ships, but the size of ships. And they were allowed to destroy the captured ships if they regarded that ships was not feasible to be carried to the port where the examination was taking place. And then often they destroyed ships harboring without crews. For the Royal Navy, these operations were coming from their successful experience of the Atlantic. And then actually, the reason why they destroyed these ships, is because these ships has a large cooking pan or large water tanks. That's why they recognize this is the slave ships and they destroyed. And this might be true for the Atlantic, but in the Western Indian Ocean, people moved here to there so frequently, merchant travel from India to East Africa, East Africa to the Persian Gulf. The Royal Navy ignored such mobility of people in the Western Indian Ocean, which was normal there in history, and applied their experience in the Atlantic to the Western Indian Ocean. So for the Royal Navy, any local ships can be slave ships, and they focus on the East African coast as if waterfront operation. Anyway, of course, local transporters got angry with the Royal Navy's way, and actually not a few cases, Nakhoda or ship owners claimed to Naval Court that their ships was destroyed without any fact that they carried slaves. And then finally, the court, in some case, admitted that their claim was true, and then compensation money was paid. This didn't make the local transporters and merchants got angry, but also this didn't only make local transporter and merchant got angry, but also European and American merchant got angry about this Royal Navy's operation. An American merchant noted that the Royal Navy's activities are raising devil with the trading doves. That's a sensational sentence, but true. But the devil is not the Royal Navy itself. Rather than that, the devil came up when the Royal Navy applied their successful method and then cognition of slave trade, which were emerged in their Atlantic experience, and then applied to the Western Indian Ocean. Here I found the cognition which spreading globally that slave trade was regarded as something universal. And this is a factor to create abolition of slavery and a slave trade as a global experience. So, in other words, successful operation of the Royal Navy in the Western Indian Ocean cannot be understood without looking at their experience, cannot understand without looking at their experience, the Royal Navy's experience in the Atlantic. And then, yeah, so, I mean, sorry, and then about their focus, the Royal Navy's focus on the East African coast, just briefly, their focus on the East African coast rather than the anti-Western Indian Ocean is a kind of selection and a concentration. I mean, often we can find, we tend to understand the significant gap of the outcome by the Royal Navy and the Indian Navy is because difference of the strengths. But that's not true. Indeed, actually, the Indian Navy was always struggling with small force, old ships, but the situation was not so different in the Royal Navy. They also didn't have a large force with latest equipment. They had to operate with old ships and not enough people. So they needed to focus on some particular spot, not the entire Western Indian Ocean. Then they set their focus on the East African coast. As some naval officer mentioned, in order to save as many lives as possible, they need to capture ships just after departure. And that makes sense. But that made patrol complicated because until 1873, coastal trade was legal along the East African coast. So it was difficult for naval officers to distinguish legal slave transporters and illegal slave transporters. And of course, transporters took advantage from this mixture of legal and illegal transport in the East African waters. And then also the other question about the chapter 5. In that chapter, I deal with the narratives of the slaves and then try to find some pattern of the slave dealing in the 19th century Western Indian Ocean and what kind of available sources for the to catch these voices of enslaved individuals and then what kind of difficulty I came across during my writing. These are the questions.
Yeah.
I regard slave trade consists of three parts mainly. One is slave trader, the second is slave themselves, and the third is those who try to suppress, especially in the context in the 19th century Western Indian Ocean. The slave trade viewed by traders, slaves, suppressing navy, would be different from each other, of course. So ideally, we can understand slave trade only when all these three experiences are entangled. But this is ideal, so easy to mention, but difficult to do. Anyway, this is one of the reasons why I focus on the slave narratives in that chapter. And the other reason is that I like to describe slave trade more vividly, lively. And I assume voices of enslaved individuals are the best source to represent the reality of slave trade. We don't have thousands of these personal narratives, and these are scattered in one file and another. So I collected one by one whenever I came across. At first, it was just for my reference. I didn't have any intention to write chapter with these narratives because I thought the number would be not enough. Then after collecting several of them, I read through again, and I found out they have commonalities. That's a chain of reselling. Buyer of slaves tended to sell not long after buying, rather than that, the time between buying and selling was short. And in some narratives, the price in each transaction was mentioned, so you can calculate profitability of transactions. And it was a good business. Here we can find out some commodification of slaves. But this is totally different from traditional usage of slaves in the Western Indian Ocean. In many societies in the Western Indian Ocean, slaves were at first for the domestic use. slavery represented master's richness or dignity, and the slaves as immature human beings were the subject to be educated into the matured. So the masters of slaves, in a sense, took some sort of social responsibility to educate the slaves, these slaves. And in the 19th century, places like Zanzibar became plantation society, and the slaves were used as a workforce at the plantation. That's a new usage of slaves. But here, we can find out the third usage of slaves as a commodity, the object of selling and buying. This is contrary to the traditional concept of slaves in the Western Indian Ocean world, who represented master's social status and richness. And remember, social responsibility to educate slaves. So in some sources, not slave nowadays, but they mention that to sell out slaves is a shameful behavior because it proves that seller could not maintain slaves' life and then could not provide enough education. But at the same time, commodification might make sense for these buyers in the situation in the 19th century Western Indian Ocean. The net to illegalize slave dealings became tighter and tighter, so people needed to take risks to be confiscated the slaves whom they newly bought. So they want to leave slaves as soon as possible, but they need to get profit. If you could sell out that slave, you can get profit and then reduce the risk of confiscation. This emergence of new usage of slaves can be understood in the perspective which include the harsh contest between slave trade and its suppression. So when we deal with personal narratives, the question always arises is the reliability of the contents. But in this case, these narratives kept in the British consular staffs are highly reliable, especially on the part of transactions, because that British officers wanted to know. They couldn't touch slave dealing within the territory of Shaifs or Sultan, but many Shaifs and the Sultans agreed importation of slaves was illegal. So British officers traced the chain of transaction, and if they could reach importation from outside the territory, they could claim the rationale of their involvement. Because of this, these slave narratives kept by British consular staffs were keen to note any information relating to the transaction, which is liable. That's why I used.
Thank you. So as you previously mentioned, the British were increasingly involved in the slave trade suppression as the 19th century progressed. But what were some of the implications for other communities for these British interventionist policies regarding this, perhaps the sovereignty of the Zanzibari Sultan, the Indian community's national affiliations, and the Dhow trade in the last decades of the 19th century?
Yeah. Well, so like a chapter 7 or 8 or 9, in these chapters, I extended my scope to other people who profit from a slave trade. Overall, these chapters shows how slave trade and its suppression was tightly entangled with many other issues. Not only many other communities, but also many other issues. Through these processes, what is important is gradually Western Indian Ocean became under the control of British Empire. Zanzibari sultans like Sultan Majd and then Sultan Suwaini, they were not like Said, their father. They couldn't exist as a sultans largely. They could exist as a sultans largely because of support by British Empire. Therefore, they were inclined into anti-slave trade policies, as I mentioned. And then it triggered instability of Zanzibar society, though. And as to the Indian community, Rigby, the British consul at Zanzibar, emancipated slaves owned by the Indian residents along the East African coast in 1860. This was the first example that the British Empire emancipated a large number of slaves in not in their own territory. But this was totally kind of overrunning because these Indian residents, many are from Kutchi, and actually they were not actually British subjects, but Rao's subjects. Rao is the king of the Kutch, so king's subject. So Rigby didn't have any right to emancipate their slaves. But this incident triggered to reveal dual protection of the Indian merchants. They got advantage as being British subjects sometimes. For example, if they had trouble, they rushed into British consul for help, while they took advantage as being Sultan's subject in other occasions as they traded in a mainland coast which British subjects were prohibited. This dual protection was controlled after this 1860s Rigby manumission, connected with ownership of the slaves. And about the French flag issue, as I told you, the Royal Navy's operation was as if any ships can be a slave ships, in their view, in their eyes. So to escape from their patrol was not only the issue for those who actually transport slaves, but also for any doubts. Their resistance included using their sailing skill and geographical knowledge, as I told you before, but the most effective method since the 60s is to hoist tricolore, French flag. Usually these dhows in the mid-19th century kept several flags on board and they hoist the most profitable one according to the occasion. But what is interesting in the French flag issue here is that they hoisted French flag after proper registration. The most of ships sailed down to Nusi Bay, and that is a small island of the Madagascar, and Mayotte. Both are French protectorate to register their ships as a French ship. And some of the ships even came from Djibouti. The reason why French flag they wanted is because French government didn't allow British Navy to investigate their own ships. Actually, French government was not the only government who can protect their own ships from a British patrol. For example, Ottoman Empire could do, but there were two problems of Ottoman flag. One is that their flag usually in a red color, and that is similar to the flags of the Persian Gulf Shifdam. And the British naval officers often made mistake. And then secondly, in the case if Ottoman ships were captured by mistake, even by mistake, the captains and the crew couldn't expect quick rescue by the Ottoman government. They had to go to Basra or the Red Sea. Instead of this, French government had a consulate around the Western Indian Ocean. So always their response was quick. That's why many local dhows got French registration and hoisted French flag to protect themselves from a British patrol. And the last stage of my chapter on this topic is in Den Haag, the Netherlands. This is very symbolic. I mean, not only the French flag issue, but also Sultan's issue in Zanzibar, and then also Indian resident nationality problem. I mean, let me tell you. Of course, British Navy regarded French flag as a big obstacle, and then finally, British government got an opportunity. In the early 20th century, French consulate in Muscat provided French registration to local Omani dhows, and the British government claimed that this violated national sovereignty of the Omani Sultan. And then eventually, this case was taken into the Permanent Court of Arbitration in 1904. Then eventually British government won the case. But what I like to remark is the scenery of the courtroom. The mediator was Austrian doctor of law appointed by Vittorio Emanuele III, the Italian emperor, and the British side intermediary was the chief justice of the US Supreme Court, while the French side was a Dutch doctor of law, and it was Den Haag. Even today, from Dubai to Amsterdam takes 7 or 8 hours. So very far, and also there was no captains of dhows, no sultan of shaifs, no one of the Western Indian notion in that courtroom. And in this situation, the use of French flag, which had protected these dhows from British patrol, was ended. I mean, these Western Indian notion locals couldn't touch this decision in any way. This is symbolic. I mean, slave traders, not only transported, but also, I mean, these Indian merchants and then even Zanzibar sultans, they took advantage from a slave trade. In my sense, they were all slave trade profiters. But in the process which they got profit from slave trade, they got help from newly introduced system, mainly by Britain. For example, they used loophole of treaties, nationality of ships, matter of subjectship. They use fully these tools in order to continue their trade, not only slaves, as I told. But anyway, more and more they relied on these tools, more and more they couldn't live from these tools. And their struggle with these tools didn't break these tools, rather than that, and strengthened these tools. And then eventually, we can reach the scenery of the courtroom in Den Haag, where no Western Indian notion locals were there. Oh, by the way, the slave trade profiters doesn't mean, as I told you, only those who get profit economically, but also politically and in any kind. If so, we have to add another profiter on the list. That was British Empire. Because through their suppression campaign, they eventually controlled Indian merchants who are very influential in many places in the Western Indian Ocean. But eventually, I mean, these Indian merchants, now they fixed at their own subjects. That's why they were under the control of British Empire. And then also, British Empire controlled maritime communication with the nationality of ships, which was now regulated. But let me tell one last thing. I mean, this doesn't mean the collapse of the Western Indian notion world. The Western Indian notion world is a world where exchange laid in its foundation. So even economically, they were dominated, still exchange continues, and even politically dominated, which I put more focus on in my book, they continue to exchange. Here we can find out resilience of the Western Indian notion world. And these control items, such as subjectship or nationality of ships, continue to exist till today, and then still it keeps enormous influence. And these are the products of the struggle between slave trade and then separation, which my book argues.
Since you began to discuss your conclusions, let's think about your conclusions a little more broadly. So who do you hope will read this book, and what sort of impact would you like it to have?
Yeah, so I'm so happy if anyone is interested in the book. Well, but especially I hope those who are interested in broader story of the Indian Ocean world per se, and then also those who are interested in a slave trade, not only the Indian Ocean world, but I hope some people working on the Atlantic slave trade are interested in my book. And more particularly, those who connect the issue of slave trade to other issues, and then locate it to much wider context. And then, I mean, if my book have an impact, probably, I mean, this book connect the slave trade. I mean, this book try to connect the issue or the struggle between slave trade and slave trade suppression to much wider context and many other issues such as the nationality of the ships or subjectship. So if my book contribute to connect slave trade to much wider context of the Indian Ocean world history or global history, that is the great pleasure to me.
Well, thank you. Well, Hideaki, we've taken up a lot of your time. To end, can you give our listeners a sense of what you're working on now, or what do you hope to work on in the future?
Well, thank you so much to listen until the last. Although my English is a little bit difficult for many of you, but yeah, let me tell you my current and future project. When I have nothing to do, I always think about my future project. Some actually many are very preposterous one, but some are nice and sexy. And actually, now I'm doing proofreading of my first Japanese books about abolition of slavery and a slave trade in a global history. And then currently, I have three projects. One is about Bombay Africans. I mean, rescued slaves who were sent to missionary station at Bombay, more precisely Nashik, some 200 kilometers away from Mumbai, and educated there, and many returned to Africa as a part of mission or accompanying with a living song. I visited Nashik this February, and then I tried to develop this project into a book project to find out how movement of the people or create the consciousness of Africa or Africanness or African through the Bombay Africans. That is one of the project. And the second is, this is something for exhibition, but the global history of made in Japan. I'm working on Japanese kanga. Kanga is East African women's clothes, and from the 1920s up to the 70s, Japanese kanga almost occupied the market. This is not the history of Africa-Japan relations, because many hands touched the flow of kanga, like Indian merchants in Kobe, British Dutch merchants in Southeast Africa, British company like Smith and Mackenzie in East Africa. They connected between manufacturers in Japan and consumers in East Africa. I try to include all of these people in the picture and then try to describe history. And then combining it, I mean, this case study with other made in Japan products, such like matches or like tiles, I like to show entangled history in the early 20th century through material culture. That is the second one. And the last one is about bonded population in the early 20th century Persian Gulf. I wanted to write some sort of ethnography of these people. The early 20th century Persian Gulf is an exception in a global experience of abolition. I mean, slavery was legal still in many places, and many were employed in a pearl industry. Early 20th century pearling was good business, but gradually World War, the Great Depression, and the invention of the culture of pearl, that business declined. And so far, I collected information on more than 2,000 bonded individuals, including self-statements. Not only diverse, but also many others, not only male, but also female. I want to dive into their world through their own statement and want to understand how they lived in the first half of the 20th century and then I try to write ethnography of them. That is the third project.
Well, it sounds like you're keeping yourself busy. I look forward to reading them. Thank you for listening to today's episode with Dr. Hideaki Suzuki, in which we explored slave trade profiteers in the Western Indian Ocean, suppression and resistance in the 19th century, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. This is your host, Robin Morse.
And I'm Ahmed Al-Mazmi.
Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.